You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF. I'm Marie Cusick. How do racial disparities show up when it comes to special education in schools? That's the focus of research conducted by my next guest, Paul Morgan, professor of education at Penn State University. Welcome to Smart Talk, Paul.
Oh, thank you, Marie. It's great to be here.
So current federal legislation actually monitors U.S. school districts, and they're looking at whether children from racial and ethnic minorities are overrepresented in special education. Mm-hmm. But what you and your colleagues have found is that minority children have been less likely than otherwise similarly achieving white children to receive special education services in the U.S. So can you just kind of explain this a little bit and talk about your work?
Sure. So there's been longstanding concern that the way that children are identified as having disabilities, including in U.S. schools, may be biased. And as a result of a series of studies began to appear in the late 60s and early 70s, that led to, over time, changes in IDEA, the law that governs how special education is implemented in the United States, such that there was increased monitoring of what's called overrepresentation of children who are racial, ethnic, or minorities. And what the federal government began to do is ask states to report on the extent to which, relative to some share of the population for children of other race and ethnicity, to what extent were children who were Black or Hispanic more likely to be represented in special education. However, more recent studies that have tried to account for other explanatory factors of why children might be identified has been repeatedly finding that if you look at children who are otherwise similar, which better tests for potential differential treatment, and so bias, that repeatedly this research indicates that relative to otherwise similar children who are white or English speaking, children of color or children who are from non-English speaking families are less likely to be identified as having disabilities. And that's observed prior to school entry, after school entry, across elementary, middle, and high school, and across a range of different data sources.
So how and why did you get interested in looking into this?
Well, it's been a concern of the field for some time, and it is, of course, an important concern. We don't want to be identifying children as having disabilities who don't have disabilities based on their the color of the skin, their language background, other factors that are relevant to whether they have a disability or not. At the same time, it's important that children who do have disabilities are being appropriately identified and provided services to which they're due. And so we started conducting analyses on this topic back in 2008. Our first study on this was published in 2010. And we were fully prepared to observe what others had been reporting, some evidence of over-identification, but that's not what we observed. In our studies, which account for other explanatory factors, including direct measures of children's academic achievement or their behavioral function in school, once we accounted for those other explanatory factors, which are important to include in tests of differential treatment, we repeatedly found that children of color, children from non-English speaking families are less likely to be identified as having disabilities and so receive services.
And just to clarify, you know, when we talk about special education, what kinds of services and what are we exactly talking about?
Right. It's a collection of services that are delivered to about 7 million children in the United States. It's a system of services funded by the federal government as well as state and local governments. The services are designed fundamentally in the following way. A child is evaluated and found to have a disability that's one of the eligible conditions under federal law. If that disability is adversely affecting the child's educational performance, then there is a series of dialogue that takes place between the school, the parents, about what kind of services might help mitigate the effects of the child's disability so he or she can be more successful academically, behaviorally, physically in the school. And so the services vary, and the setting for the services vary. But this might include meeting with a teacher, a special education teacher, to get more explicit systematic instruction and reading, say, than the child might otherwise be exposed to in the classroom. Some sort of a system for better managing how the child is regulating his or her behavior, physical supports that allow the child to better access the curriculum in various ways. And so the services are individualized for the child. The setting tends to vary, although most children at this point who have disabilities are receiving services in general education classrooms most of the time. And there is strong empirical evidence that indicates that these services can be effective in terms of increasing the child's success in school, including academically.
Paul, I just want to ask about one example is something you looked at, attention deficit and hyperactivity disorder, or ADHD, which is, I believe it's the most common mental health disorder diagnosed in children. What did you find there? You found some pretty big disparities, right?
Sure. So we followed a nationally representative sample of children from kindergarten entry to the end of eighth grade in data collected by the U.S. Department of Education. And we examined over time likelihoods of being identified as having ADHD, starting in kindergarten until the end of eighth grade. And in making estimates for children who vary by their race and ethnicity, we adjusted for measures of academic achievement, behavioral functioning, family SES, history of low birth weight, other potential explanatory factors of differentials in diagnosis. And what you found is, what we found are sort of two patterns. One, as children age, their likelihood of being identified as having ADHD increases. Two, across racial and ethnic groups, children who are Black, Hispanic, or of other race and ethnicity were less likely to be diagnosed as having ADHD. And then further, among those children who did have a diagnosis of ADHD, Black, Hispanic, and other racial and ethnic background children were less likely to be using medication, which is an evidence-based treatment for managing the disorder.
You've said that really there is this widely held belief that special education is used as a tool kind of against students of racial and ethnic minorities. So a sort of segregation within education to kind of label them. But that's not what you've been finding, the opposite. So why and how did this sort of common understanding or belief arise?
Right. That's a great question. So there have been what I would characterize as strong claims based on weak empirical evidence. So what's an example? So an example from public health and medicine would be if you observed that, say, Black or Hispanic children were overrepresented among those being diagnosed as asthma, then some would claim pediatricians are therefore racially biased and we should adopt policies and legislation in which we're individually monitoring pediatric clinics, making sure that they don't exceed some artificial numerical target for how often children of color are being diagnosed as having asthma, and we will therefore reduce these disparities. That's essentially what's been taking place in education. But of course, it's important when investigating potential differential treatment is take into account differences in prevalence rate for asthma or a disability that might occur because of differential exposure to the risk factors for that condition. And that's what public health and medical researchers have done. They've looked at racial differences in asthma and found that differential exposure to environmental toxins and allergens largely explains those disparities. That has not been done in education. And so we and others have been attempting to account for other explanatory factors. Children are more likely to be identified as having disabilities if they're struggling in school. accounting for between group differences in academic achievement. Once you do that, you find consistent evidence of under identification for children of color and those from non-English speaking households. So I'll stop there. If that, does that make sense? Or
No, I guess just one question I have is how do the children get identified? Because, you know, you think about medical settings where a parent would have a concern and take them to the doctor versus like the school's role. How does the school and the medical community intersect here?
That's a great question. So in large part, it's that process tends to be based on parental concern or teacher referral within the school. Just to back up for a moment, these services tend to be expensive, and you have to hire personnel with specialized training in order to provide them. There are many examples in which you find that schools are disincentivized to provide the services because they are costly. As a result, you'll find many anecdotal reports of parents that had to really fight to obtain the services from the school district, including going to court, which is, of course, quite expensive. So largely, and to speak broadly, the process tends to be driven more by teachers or parents, particularly in terms of school-based disability identification. Oftentimes, the school is disincentivized to provide the services because of their cost. And those parents that have greater resources tend to be the ones that obtain the services as a result.
Paul, so your research suggests that we ought to really change the way the federal government legislates and regulates this issue, because it's really the opposite problem that they thought they had, which was
right.
So what solutions or what do you think needs to really be changed, and how should we handle this?
Right. And just to make a couple of points. One, there is evidence of overrepresentation as a raw descriptive statistic or unadjusted percentage difference. Two, I'm speaking in terms of population level data, overall averages. So that's important. There might be individual differences in terms of some of what's been occurring with individual families. But overall, across many studies, many data sets, and many types of analyses, we find repeated evidence of under-identification. So what should be occurring? At the minimum, from my perspective, the federal government has gotten the answer wrong in terms of the legislation or regulation, because they don't account for any indicators of clinical need. So there should be some attempt when examining this important issue to compare children who seem otherwise similar in terms of their clinical need for services. That's not being done. And that would be relatively easy to do given the prevalence of so many national and statewide data systems that would allow for an accounting of that type. So in monitoring for this problem, there should be some attempt to compare children who seem otherwise similar, particularly on the factors most materially relevant to being identified as having a disability, which includes difficulties academically.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. But thank you so much, Paul Morgan, for sharing your work and your research. He's a professor of education at Penn State University. Thank you to all of our guests on the show today. Brent Moritz, Associate Professor of Supply Chain Management at Penn State University, and Ian Langella, Professor of Supply Chain Management at Shippensburg University. I'm Marie Cusick. Thank you so much for being with us today.